Welcome to All Sides with Anna Stever. Donald Trump has promised to end inflation, bring down the price of groceries, reshore American manufacturing, and cut taxes. It's an ambitious set of economic policies, and the president-elect has been light on the details, which is why we here at All Sides wanted to learn more, get some perspective on how these different ideas might impact our pocketbooks and how they might all work or perhaps not work together, especially since 2 out of 3 voters said our country was on the wrong track on Election Day. Joining us now to talk about what President-elect Donald Trump's economic plans would mean for all of us is a professor of economics at Robert Morris University in Pennsylvania, Brian O'Rourke. Welcome back to All Sides, Brian.
Hey, Anna, it's great to be back with you.
Donald Trump's closing message that Harris broke it and he will fix it appears to have resonated with American voters. Those deciding in the final weeks of the election broke for Trump, and they told pollsters overwhelmingly that the country was on the wrong track. So, Brian, I think we should start with what track the country is on. So how is the economy? How do economists look at where we are right now?
Well, there's two ways to look at things. The first is to look at them from the individual perspective. And most individuals are still struggling with the reality of inflation. Even though the rate of price changes has declined significantly, prices are still going up. And as people's incomes haven't gone up as fast as those price changes, when you go to the grocery store and you're still experiencing sticker shock, at the microeconomic level, individuals and individual households are still experiencing some significant discomfort with the state of the economy. The other side of this, though, is that if you look at the macroeconomic perspective, so you look at the big picture of the economy, things are really good. Like I mentioned, the inflation rate has come down quite substantially. Unemployment is still really, really low, and economic growth is happening. We are, most of what I've read around from perspectives coming across the pond, and people in Europe and people in Asia are still looking at the United States as the envy of the world economically, and it is from a macroeconomic perspective, but people don't live at the macroeconomic level; they live at the microeconomic level. And when they keep seeing prices going up, that's still harming people. And so, I think that's the economic story from the election was it wasn't unemployment, because most people who wanted jobs had them. It was still the inflation story.
Yeah, here's part of Trump's closing message to voters.
And I'd like to begin by asking a very simple question. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I'm here today with a message of hope for all Americans. With your vote in this election, I will end inflation. I will stop the invasion of criminals coming into our country. And I will bring back the American dream. We need the American dream to come back home. Our country will be bigger, better, bolder, richer, safer, and stronger than ever before.
I mean, it's the economy stupid, right? It's the fundamental of, are you better today than you were 4 years ago?
Yeah, that's a question that always sort of determines who the winner is, I think. If the answer is yes, I am better, then the incumbent stays in power. And if the answer is no, I'm still struggling with these economic problems, then we see the outcome that happened, the beginning of November. So of course, there's a lot of hyperbole in electioneering.
Oh yeah.
The idea of ending inflation. I don't think anybody expects inflation to be zero. I mean, no economist expects inflation to be zero, and we plan for that. We just don't want inflation to be 9%, and or higher, as it is in too many other places, parts of the world. You know, so that is very hyperbolic. But yeah,
as most campaign messages are, we're going to get into that a little bit as we go on. But one of the things I find really fascinating is that President Barack Obama didn't seem to get blamed for the Great Recession. You know, he won re-election in 2012, and arguably the economy was still recovering. But Biden, the Biden-Harris administration, really took the blame for the economic havoc wrought by the pandemic.
Yeah, so I think Obama had this benefit of things were bad when he started, and they weren't nearly as bad when it came time for a re-election. Biden, I mean, we could see a similar pattern where things were really, really bad when it started. They weren't as bad when it ended. But I think what was bad was different. So for Biden, it's that inflation. And people had been going for a long, long time without experiencing inflation. And inflation is really hard to get rid of. It's really hard to say, hey, inflation rates are down. You know, they're lower than they were before. And so your life is better. But people still see the prices going up. And that's what happens with inflation. Inflation is persistent. It increases over time. The Fed's target, the Federal Reserve Bank, they have a target of 2% inflation. Their target is not 0%. So when you see prices are higher than they were before, they're continuing to increase. You look at that and say, how can I make ends meet? With Obama, in his situation, it was unemployment rates were coming down and people were saying, oh my golly, look, more people are working. This is really good. He didn't have the same
set of
extent of the inflationary pressures.
Yeah. And that's the thing of it. Like, inflation only matters so much as wages, because inflation for 2022, part of like 2023, like it was outpacing wage growth. So real purchasing power, real dollars, the value of your salary was getting less. And that's the pinch.
Absolutely. Yeah. You very succinct. Well put.
Yeah. So let's talk about, so cutting inflation down to zero might not actually be a great economic choice, given that our economy is centered around growth. But let's assume that he keeps it at like 2%. That would be on pace with about what wages grow, right? Like, that's probably like this idea of ending inflation. I wonder if he's really talking about like keeping it at a historic low.
I think Trump's been in business long enough. He understands the inflationary environment.
But I will keep it low is not the campaign slogan you want.
No, you're right. That's exactly right. Yeah, there's a huge difference here between what's politically expedient and what's economically viable.
So the president-elect loves tariffs. And here he is during an interview with Bloomberg News.
We're going to bring the companies back. We're going to lower taxes still further for companies that are going to make their product in the USA. We're going to protect those companies with strong tariffs, because I'm a believer in tariffs. I'm not sure that you are. I don't think you are, but I congratulate you on your career. But to me, the most beautiful word in the dictionary is tariff. And it's my favorite word. It needs a public relations firm.
So Trump says the most beautiful word in the English language is tariffs. And after the election in particular, Google saw a huge spike in the search for what is a tariff. So let's start there. What is a tariff?
Tariffs are really easy to understand. They're taxes. It's just a different kind of tax. So a tariff is a tax that's placed on goods that are coming into a country. So as something that has a tariff on it, as it comes into the United States, as it enters the ports, there is a tax that's slapped on the importer of the good. They have to pay a certain amount of money. It goes to Borders and Customs, and that money ends up in the Treasury.
And so a way to kind of conceptualize it, if I'm building a building, let's say, I'm going to build a big building, it's going to require steel, commercial construction. And a lot of steel is made in China. And so I want to buy steel from China to make the beams for my building. And today it costs $100 a beam. Totally probably not what it costs, but it's just easy to conceptualize, right? So the tariff would be, I'm going to now maybe pay $150, depending on like what Trump wants to do. And the idea is that if there is American steelmakers at like $130, they are now the better deal, but I'm still going to pay more for the American good if it exists.
That is absolutely correct. So the tariffs are designed to help domestic production producers, to make them more competitive.
And there's lots of reasons, non-economic ones, why we might want to do that.
Oh, sure. I mean, you can go back to people like Adam Smith, who's held up as this bastion of free market economic. He's the stalwart of free market economics, and there are instances where he advocates for tariffs. There's the question of, do you want certain industries to be able to be competitive, and do you want them to be headquartered domestically? There are arguments for national defense purposes. You want certain industries in your country. Certainly, there are political reasons for tariffs, because there is the reality that jobs move out of your country if your domestic production can't be competitive. There are certainly arguments that are made. Domestic producers love tariffs because, well, for two reasons. One, it allows them to be more competitive. But one of the really interesting points of research when it comes to tariffs is that if you put a tariff, I'm going to use your example, if you put that 50% tariff on Chinese steel, and so Chinese steel is now $150, and the $130 U.S. steel is now competitive, what a lot of research has shown is that the American steel doesn't stay at $130. It actually goes up to $140, $145. So, the people making steel are not stupid. If the Chinese steel is now higher priced, the American steel becomes higher priced too.
Yeah. And if you want to join our conversation this hour, if you have a economic question about Trump's policies, a comment, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email your comments to allsides@wosu.org. Ultimately, what we're talking about here, though, since so many of our products are made overseas, is we could be talking about everything from, air fryers to hair dryers being more expensive.
Yeah.
Anything I like alliteration. I couldn't resist that.
That was well done. Yeah. shows you're a professional here. there are, anytime you have a tariff put on any product, the price is going to go up. The position that Trump has staked that someone else will pay for the tariff, it's only partially true. So usually when you put a tax in place, the tax is shared somehow between the producer and the consumer. The tax doesn't all go right onto the consumers.
It looks like we may be having a little bit of technical difficulty with Professor Brian O'Rourke. I will just remind folks that if they have an economic question, they have a question about some of Trump's policies, we have the phone lines open. You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. The Tax Foundation, a U.S. think tank, estimates that raising tariffs could raise prices and reduce consumer spending power. That perhaps goes opposite of what the president-elect says will happen. Because if everything gets more expensive, I mean, how is that different than inflation? Or is it inflation? I don't know. Can tariffs be inflationary?
Oh, sure. Yeah, as they're raising prices, as tariffs cause prices to go up, that's the definition of inflation. So this is the first sort of salvo from economists when Trump began advocating for these really high tariffs, was that you're going to cause more inflation. Inflation is coming down. The last thing we need now is for prices to go up because of these trade barriers.
And it can prompt other countries to put their own trade barriers in. So China could say put a tariff on soybeans, which we export a lot to them.
Oh, yeah. In fact, the European governments are already planning potential retaliatory tariffs against the United States. I'm sure the Chinese have done the same. That's the pattern of tariff policy, is that, I mean, if you go back, so the most infamous of all tariffs is the Smoot-Hawley tariff
I
from
was
the
going to
Great
ask you
Depression.
about that because there is this clip from Ferris Bueller's Day Off circulating on social media where Ben Stein is this like history professor talking about it. And yeah, can you tell us what the Hawley Smoot Tariff Act was?
Sure. So, forgive me if this sounds familiar, but at the beginning of the Great Depression, the economic activity in the United States was declining, and two members of Congress, one from the Senate, one from the House, got together and wrote this bill and said basically, too many things are being produced overseas. We're losing jobs to companies overseas. We want to keep those jobs here. So let's put these tariffs in place. The tariffs, if I remember correctly, were as high as 59% on a lot of goods. And that raised the prices that consumers would have to pay for these imported goods. And as a result, people bought a lot less stuff from overseas. The downside of that, so imports into the United States fell by 66%. However, when our tariffs went up in other parts of the world. And so not only did our imports go down by 66%, our exports went down as well. Exports from the United States dropped by over 60%. So if you're producing goods in the United States and selling them overseas, well, now you don't have any jobs for your employees. The Smoot-Hawley tariff is probably unfairly blamed for the prolonging of the Great Depression, but it was a part, because as other countries retaliate against us, not only do the things that we used to buy from them, we buy less of them, we buy those goods from other countries because they're cheaper. So now the replacement goods are more expensive, and we're not selling as much to other parts of the world. That's the pattern of tariffs, especially tariff wars. As you step into the markets and try to interfere with them, you end up causing, there are side effects. There are certainly consequences that you better pay attention to.
That's Brian O'Rourke, professor of economics at Robert Morris University in Pennsylvania. Coming up, no taxes on tips, cuts for the middle class, and more of Trump's economic plans and what they will mean for all of us. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. President-elect Donald Trump has a list of economic policies he claims will end inflation, lower the price of groceries, and bring manufacturing back to America. It is quite the set of promises, as most presidents make, and we wanted to explore whether they will work the way he has hoped. Still with us is Brian O'Rourke, professor of economics at Robert Morris University in Pennsylvania. Exit polls show inflation and the price of groceries were on the minds of American voters when they went to the polls on Election Day. At its peak, prices were up 13%, but that's come back down, and the price of eggs has not. We briefly touched on this in the last segment, but, you know, to get the price of eggs down, to actually lower the price of groceries, common sense says to me, you've got to lower demand.
Lowering demand on food is a tough one.
Yeah, because no matter what, we got to eat.
We got to eat. The alternative, sort of the flip side of that, would be to increase supply.
Yeah.
And I think this, This eggs is a particularly interesting thing. I eat a lot of eggs,
Good.
and I've noticed the prices,
Oh, yeah.
vacillating wildly. And I think this is one of the interesting things about economics as a whole is you never know when something's going to get, some kind of grit is going to get thrown into the gears and mess up the way things are supposed to work. So with eggs, you've got issues of bird flu that keep popping up. And bird flu is fatal to the birds, and if you have to eliminate the birds, you've got to that reduces the supply of eggs.
Yeah, you have to kill the
And
whole flock sometimes because of exposure or quarantine them. It's not like you just take the one sick bird out and you're okay.
right. And so in that particular market, so when the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes their inflation data, they pull out these specific things, and eggs, the last time the data came out, eggs was there, and you see this bar of how high prices for eggs have been. It's those interesting little problems that you see in individual markets that can, totally scuttle the best intentions of policymakers.
Yeah.
And that's what makes a lot of this really hard. If it was easy, we wouldn't be dealing with inflation.
Yeah. I like to bake, so the price of butter and eggs in particularly have really hit me in these moments. And I think it's such an easy thing to say. You've seen the price of eggs, I've seen the price of eggs or butter or bread or cereal, and it really resonates to be like, hey, this is way more expensive than it used to be. Somebody needs to do something to change this. But gas went down during the pandemic to about a dollar, but that's because no one was driving.
Right. So that's again, it's an individual market. It's demand and supply, and demand and supply still is the reason why prices change. We can try to create policies that are going to help, or let me say this, we can create policies with certain intentions, but policies are kind of like pharmaceutical drugs. There's always a side effect to policy. And sometimes those policies cause demand to increase or decrease. Sometimes it causes supply to increase or decrease, and that impacts prices, sometimes in ways we don't expect.
Yeah. Whether our economy needs to be based on growth is an entirely different conversation, though, about whether we should be creating and consuming more stuff every year after year. But that's a more esoteric conversation about like economies more broadly. I do wonder, though, whether declining birth rates might force a conversation about growth.
That's an interesting question because that affects both demand and supply side. Clearly, if you have fewer people, demand is going to go down for everything. You have fewer people, the supply of labor goes down, and your ability to produce changes as well. And I mean, I think this is also one of those questions that economists have about Trump policy when it comes to things like immigration. So immigration is a way to help solve problems of too few people working. And it's not just too few people working, it's too few people paying taxes. So if there are fewer people in our economy working and fewer people paying taxes, then one of two things has to happen. Either you have to cut programs or you have to raise taxes on the people who are working. That's one of the interesting angles, I think, for policymakers is, are we going to try to adjust the size of government? This is, whatever you think of Elon Musk and
Vivek Ramaswamy.
thank you. easy for you to
He's from
say.
Ohio, so I've
Oh,
had a lot of
okay.
practice.
Okay. If you are going to have fewer people paying taxes, you need to cut government somewhere, and we'll see what happens. A reorganization isn't a bad thing. And sometimes a reorganization is a really, really good thing. But
Yeah, we're going to dive into the tax cuts in just a moment, but I do have a email question from Peter in Grandview, and he wants to know just how much
a president really does have influence over things like reducing inflation, because presidents get the credit and they also get the blame. But I don't know that they actually affect it the way they say they can.
Well, there are ways that they can affect things, but it requires cooperation with other parts of government. So in that sense, a president cannot unilaterally do these things. That's the way, you know, the government is set up so that individuals are not supposed to have so much power that they can interfere with the lives of the people being governed. And that's a good thing. But that's correct. You know, presidents get the blame and presidents get the credit. They get the blame they don't deserve and they get the credit they don't deserve most of the time. So presidential policy can guide government action, but a president cannot, you know, flip the switch in the Oval Office and say inflation's going to go away, because things happen. They have to deal with world events. They have to deal with the Fed. They have to deal with...
I was going to say, we're going to talk about the Fed and interest rates in a minute, because the Fed chair had some choice words about what he plans to do during a Trump presidency.
Yeah. It's a great question. And I think as voters, we are naturally inclined to give credit to whoever's in office and place the blame on whoever's in office at the time of an election.
So Trump talked a lot about making things more affordable for middle-class Americans. He, you know, the forgotten man. Here's a clip of him kind of laying out some of that.
From today and from the day I take the oath of office, we will rapidly drive prices down and make America affordable again. We're going to make it affordable again. Under Kamala Harris and crooked Joe Biden, the American dream is dead. You don't hear about the American dream anymore. It's dead. Her radical liberal policies have caused horrific inflation, decimated the middle class, and gutted the finances of millions and millions of American families. Real incomes are down by over $2,000 a year per family. I mean, that's a lot of money. They're down by that, and it's actually much more if you figure it a certain way. If you add some other categories in, it's much more than that. But down by 2,000 since she took office, and it was just announced that real earnings were down once again at a record rate. The Harris price hikes have cost the typical household $28,000. Congratulations. Hope everyone's happy.
I mean, some of those numbers, there's different conversations. I think at one point, real wages were down about two. I think we're now down about $400 from where we were a couple years ago. So we've made up a lot of that real wage loss, but we're still feeling it. And I know we've been talking about that, but he's got some interesting ideas on how to give relief to those people that are still saying, I'm not making any more in terms of purchasing power. One of them is he wants to eliminate taxes on tips and overtime pay. This one fascinates me. And I because we don't normally give tax breaks to like specific groups of people that earn their income in a very specific way. Like, this feels really different.
It is different. You're absolutely right. One of the things that makes this different is that it is increasing the complexity of the tax code by targeting certain groups of people who make certain amounts of income in unique ways. So, you know, usually when we talk about tax cuts, they're tax rate cuts for everybody who is paying tax at some point. These particular tax proposals are targeting pretty narrow groups of people. I know originally this was thought to be an attempt to curry favor with voters in Nevada, was sort of the original, I think.
Lots of service industry workers there.
Right. And you know, so, okay, you know, that's the prerogative of policymakers to target people in such ways. But, you know, it's a peculiar way of going about trying to use tax policy, in part because if you look at, and I'm going to go kind of macroeconomic here, if you look at the number of people and the earnings of people who are working in the tipped businesses, we're not talking about a lot of money, and we're not talking a lot about a lot of people in terms of the percentage of the workforce who are working tipped jobs. We're talking roughly about 2% of the workforce is in the tipped business in tipped yeah. industries. And I know from experience that a lot of people who earn tips, and this is probably changing because of the way people tip, but if people tip in cash, that it is very unlikely that those cash tips are being reported anyway. So I'm not sure how, well, this is not going to have a big impact on that many people's yeah. lives. And it's not going to have that big of an impact on the federal budget or anything, yeah, anything at the federal level, really.
But the way he indicated he would pay for it, I thought was really interesting. So he would eliminate it from both federal income and payroll taxes. And what that essentially means is you would get the money now, but you'd probably get smaller Social Security payments when you retire. And I don't know yeah. that people quite understood that what he was saying was you can keep it now, but what you're going to earn from Social Security is going to decline because you're not going to pay into it as much.
Yeah. From a personal finance perspective, that can be a good thing.
Depending on what you do with the money. Yeah, absolutely.
That's exactly right. That's the thing. You know, so if people are educated about how to save for their retirement, saving, putting that money away now is a really good thing because you can benefit from this over time, you know, without getting into the details too much. The longer you have that money being saved and invested, the more you will have at the end of when it's time to retire. But for people on tipped wages, they're not making that much. So it's unlikely that they're going to take advantage of those opportunities from a personal finance perspective.
And you got to know that's what's happening in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
But if you're going to save, yeah.
Well, I think one other thing about this, though, is, you know, the idea of targeting groups, you know, the tipped workers and the overtime pay, those policies, as I've said a couple times, can have consequences. And some of the consequences are likely to be that other workers who are not currently being paid tips and workers who are on salary and not getting paid overtime, a lot of businesses will try to reclassify their workers so that they are tipped workers if they can.
Or have overtime.
Exactly. Because that has the potential to allow businesses to pay their workers less and sort of push the cost of employing people onto the tipper. So, you know, if you know that the people working in the hotels are not, if they're, so in Ohio, I'm sure you know this, the tip minimum wage is $5.05 an hour. The federal tip wage is $2.13.
Yeah.
So if I, as an employer, can change the way I pay my workers because they are now tipped, I'm happy to pay them the federal minimum tipped wage and then encourage my clients to increase the amount that they tip because these workers really work hard and they do, and they need these tips, which they will if I'm only paying them $2.13 an hour.
Yeah. Trump's also proposed capping the interest rate for credit cards at 10%. That is about half of where it is right now. He's also talked about making the interest we pay on car loans tax deductible the way our mortgage interest rates are tax deductible. So, I mean, those are really interesting ideas. Like, fundamentally, like, credit card companies sometimes, yeah, I don't know, capping them at 10%, would that really have a big impact?
Actually, it would have an enormous impact and probably not in the way you think.
Okay.
I mean,
that's
as
why
someone,
I'm asking.
Yeah. So as someone who borrows money, so that's when you use a credit card, you're borrowing money and you have to pay interest on that if you don't pay the bill off every month. Those high interest rates are one way for the companies who issue the credit cards to protect themselves from people who don't pay their credit card bills. if you lower that interest rate to 10%, it is going to severely reduce the number of people who can get credit in that way, because credit card companies will simply not issue credit cards to people who have sketchy credit. And that will slow economic activity down. I can think of having higher or lower interest rates, having fewer people borrow money on a credit card as being a good thing, because it limits your ability to get into debt. But it's also a bad thing, because sometimes people need to have access to credit to make purchases. So if you're going to change that interest rate, that's going to change the nature of the credit card industry. Maybe in some cases there will be good positive stories there. And in some cases, I think more cases, it will be bad. In terms of allowing people to deduct the interest on their car loans, that has, it sounds great. It says to me as a potential car buyer, I'm going to go buy a car that's maybe more expensive than the one I intended to, because the ability to deduct the interest makes that purchase a little cheaper. But again, the car companies know this, so it's likely that car prices will go up. It is also likely that there will be that people will try to extend the length of time that they borrow money for a car, so that they have more time to write that interest off over time. And that is, as someone who is inherently conservative in my own personal finances, I find extending the length of time that I have to borrow out, being incentivized to borrow more money for longer periods of time, I find that to be somewhat unnerving. I don't like that idea.
We're going to take a quick break. Coming up, how mass deportations might impact our economy. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about President-elect Donald Trump's economic policies this hour and what they will mean for all of us. Still with us is Brian O'Rourke, professor of economics at the Robert Morris University in Pennsylvania. Trump's plan to deport people living in this country illegally is in many ways a plan for the economy. He claims that immigrants take American jobs. And I want to take a call from Lisa in Lancaster, who's been waiting patiently to ask this immigration question. Welcome to All Sides, Lisa.
Thanks so much, Anna, and great show. I'm so glad you're doing the show, and I'm going to ask if you would continue to do a show a week on these topics, because it's so important. My question really is about mass deportation and the potential impact of cratering our economy as it relates to food production. If this economy was really about the cost of a dozen eggs that had people making a decision to vote as the second largest egg producing state in the nation, mass deportation would have a direct impact on our ability to continue to do anything in the way of agriculture, food production, meat processing, especially eggs. And eggs continue to be one of the most affordable sources of protein that people can purchase. I'd like to hear from you as an economist what you believe mass deportation will do to our food systems, which still are some of the most inexpensive of industrialized nations. Cutting government is one thing, but if this was really about the cost of a dozen eggs, is it true that mass deportation is going to drive up food costs and crater the economies of food production in the U.S.? And again, thank you for your time, and I'll take your response off the air.
Thanks, Lisa. Okay, Brian, what happens when you deport all the people in the country who are here without documentation.
All right. So we're going to make the assumption that
that actually happens.
This is possible. Okay.
Yes.
So if this happens,
we're going to fiat it into existence.
Yes. There are certain industries, and Lisa is absolutely right that agriculture is one of those industries that will be more affected than others. If you get rid of people who work in agriculture, the apple pickers, the tomato pickers, the people who work in the poultry industry, the people who work in meat packing, you're going to have to find people to replace them. This is one of the areas where AI is not up to the task of replacing humans. And if you don't have workers to do that, then there will be a lot of good food that goes to waste. Farmers can plant all the crops they want, but if no one's there to pick them, then that fruit rots on the vine. And when you go to the grocery store, what's there is going to be more expensive. And if economics tells us anything, it tells us that if supply drops and demand doesn't change, prices will go up. And if you are worried about inflation, this is going to make inflation worse. And I don't think there's really anything else that can be done about that short of encouraging native-born Americans to become farmers again. And one of the great, great, great advantages of technology over the last 100 years is that we are not all farmers, that big farms are able to produce lots and lots and lots of food, and that frees us up to do other things in life. So agriculture is going to be harmed significantly if the workers are deported. There are other industries that are going to face similar problems. One of them is the construction industry. There are lots of people who work in construction who are not legal citizens. And if you're worried about the price of housing and we get rid of a number of people who work in construction, then the supply of housing is not going to continue to grow. And that's going to keep prices high in the housing markets as well. So there are lots of really significant downsides to mass deportation. I think the solution, from my view, is not to deport people. It's to help them to help them on the path to citizenship so that they can stay here and work in those industries where, you know, we're in Native Americans are just Native born Americans, I should say, are simply not interested in working.
I think the most concrete example that I always come back to of this is Georgia. So back in 2011, Republicans passed a law making it a crime to transport people in the country illegally, gave the police authority to stop anyone they suspected of being here without documentation. It was one of those show me your papers laws if you follow politics pretty closely. So after that happened, Georgia's farmers and agricultural commissioner had to go to state lawmakers and say that this didn't go as planned. There was a farm labor shortage. They were short like 11,000 workers that season. Crops rotted in the fields. Georgia's fruit and vegetable growers said they collectively lost about $75 million that season. So, people don't like to pick stuff. It's hard, grueling work. There are pesticides. There's sun. There's sweat. But what they asked for and what potentially, like if Trump wanted to get rid of everyone in the country who was here illegally and he doesn't want to put them onto a path to citizenship, and what they were really lobbying for, what I've heard Ohio farmers lobby for, is a big expansion of the guest worker program. Let them come for the harvest, then let them return. Because a lot of times the agricultural workers in particular would like that four months off schedule.
That's another way to deal with labor problems. And the more above board you make these jobs, the easier it's going to be to collect taxes. And if people come here for a period of time and leave again and pay taxes while they're here, that is a good thing for the federal budget. It's a good thing for the programs that people say they want government to engage in.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting. I have always said if we're going to have a serious conversation about immigration, we need to have a serious conversation about where our food comes from. And the reason they're coming is because there are jobs.
Yeah. I mean, America has been blessed with great natural resources. And one of those natural resources is the ability to grow food. But it's hard work and we need someone to do it. And, you know, until we say, okay, you know, you don't have to go to school anymore, kids, as long as you go out into the fields to work, we're going to have to find that labor supply from somewhere else.
Trump's also got some other ideas that are a little wonky, which is kind of why I saved them for the end. He wants to end something called the state and local tax deduction, or SALT. And it's primarily benefits the residents of high tax blue states like New York, New Jersey, California. So allowing you to deduct that amount that you pay in state and local taxes off your federal burden. Right now, you can only do 10 grand, but removing it entirely would cost $1 trillion over 10 years. And this kind of leads into the final, like, okay, we're going to take that money out. Now what?
When you talk about federal budgets, or when you talk about government budgets, or personal budgets, there are two sides to the budget. There is the expense side, and you can cut expenses all you want, but if you eliminate too much revenue, you're not going to be able to cut your expenses far enough. This is one of the conflicts that people have with federal government budgets. Is I don't want to pay my taxes. I really personally hate paying taxes. I write a check to my state. I write a check to the federal government. I write a check to my local government. I write a check for my school board. I write a check for my county. I hate paying taxes. But the government does need revenue in order to do the things that make life a little bit easier. Even if you don't agree with any of the sort of social programs that governments engage in, you still want there to be roads. You would still probably prefer that kids go to school and get an education, and those things cost money.
Probably so, would prefer police, fire departments.
Yeah, police are a good thing. Absolutely. I don't want to hire my own security forces. And those are things that governments need resources and revenues to do. So if you cut, there is a point beyond which even the most conservative economists will tell you can't actually operate a government anymore. So, I mean, there's the idea that you can cut taxes and increase economic activity, and that will increase revenues. But there is also, in that theory of taxation, there is the point beyond which you've cut too far, and you've cut taxes too far. And if you don't massively cut programs, then the house will collapse.
Yeah. Trump's also talked about putting the Federal Reserve under the executive branch. That would change things.
Yeah. And I'm glad we have time just to talk about this, even if it's just for a minute or two. I remember in graduate school, there was a series of papers that came out on something called central bank independence, and how central banks being independent of the political system was a very good thing for economies across the globe. Because the president and the Congress conduct fiscal policy, so that's the taxing and spending policies, and they are not involved in monetary policy, which is what the Fed does, there is conflict between those two policy-making bodies. And sometimes the conflict works together, and sometimes the conflict works against each other. And what I would fear is that if the Fed does not maintain its independence, then, to put it mildly, funny business will begin to happen. You know, the tax side of things can be left alone, and we just mess around with the money supply. When you start messing around with the money supply, that's where inflation comes from. So we're back to inflation. It's kind of all goes back to inflation. And when your money supply and your monetary policy is not stable because it's going to be conducted by a group that is inherently political, then your economy itself becomes more destabilized. This is, I remember when this was first floated, and friends of mine across the political spectrum, economist friends of mine across the political spectrum, were aghast. This was like the worst possible idea they could have ever thought of.
That was Professor of Economics, Brian O'Rourke. Thank you so much, as always.
Thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.